Obtaining these sometimes happens under fortuitous circumstances, others because we try to take advantage of the momentary condition of incidents or accidental facts that allow us to seize the opportunity. It goes without saying that we avoid causing harm to anyone, our only goal being the future common good. We can pick up your radio broadcasts, including the TV programs televised all over the world, and we often enjoy watching their sports matches, political rallies, exhibitions of various kinds, commemorative festivals, their aquatic competitions, and many other competitions held on Earth. From certain casual accidents in the Earth human's life, we try to draw positive lessons for our people, highlighting their mistakes and their natural consequences. So as a result of events, we analyze what is useful and usable, excluding the negative. These magnificent conclusions have the primary and salutary purpose of strengthening our faith, making us more grateful to the Creator for seeing us placed in a peaceful world, full of stillness and love, when there are other creatures placed in a marvelous world, full of enchantments, and, despite being enlightened, demean it, modus facendi, with their own, spreading evil and forgetting that they are there temporarily. Without the proper gratitude towards God, men violate His supreme goodness, who assists them in His eternal benevolence at every moment of their lives, in order to become vain and opulent when they are constituted in a society, state or nation. But this is truly astonishing, was my exclamation, and in the same vein, my interlocutor continued to expound his considerations, which can be summarized as follows. The Earth is not in the condition of the underdeveloped worlds, but at the stage of an enlightened world, where its components already clearly distinguish between good and evil. It is akin to a dangerous criminal who knowingly breaks the law and, as such, needs to be constantly watched so as not to constitute a possible danger. In short, the activities of its inhabitants feed a boiling cauldron, where passions ferment in the desire for wealth, dominance and other inferior tendencies, to the point of not even sparing their own fellow human beings to fulfill their appetites. They use scientific discoveries to engineer destruction, and we know that they will not hesitate to cause greater harm in their plans to empower themselves, thus affecting the economy of other neighboring planets. He paused for a long time and then finished, "That's why we know a little about your earthly life." Then he added, "Let's forget about it, don't worry. Dear brother, let's get on with our visit, as you're running out of time." That done, he stood in front of me and placing his hands on my shoulders, he ordered me to move my eyes from side to side and vice versa. For a few minutes he examined me and took my pulse. He listened for a long time and then said, "You're resisting satisfactorily." I was enchanted by Dr. Janzel's magnificent lectures and astonished. I was immediately interested in learning more about this strange world, attaching little importance to my state of health. I felt great well-being and was in excellent physical condition, as well as being in an excellent mood. After this perfunctory examination, Dr. Janzel went on to explain, "We're in the eastern part of the city, at the end of the avenues through which the community vehicles travel, and in this area are the places of worship, schools and sports centers." As we walked along, he began to refer to the fields of worship where religion is practiced, which is based on three fundamental points: 1. Deep respect for God and His creation. 2. Effective and continuous practice of His teachings. 3. Study in order to broaden knowledge of the universe. And, extending his remarks, he finalized with the following concept: the greater our knowledge of the universe, the more we realize and feel God's infinite goodness, greatness and power. In the religious camps, there are about 40 large standard shelters, that is rounded, without side walls, whose convex roofs, facing upwards, are supported by symmetrically arranged columns. The shelters hold hundreds of stools. On a higher level, there are 8 larger stools arranged in a straight line, where the masters or priests sit. Whilst on the round table we could see one of the well-known videophone screens. I realized that the layout of the facilities allowed the teachings to be administered simultaneously, as the masters sit back to back, 8 on one side and 8 on the other, with groups of their students in front of them. On the perimeter of the same area, but outside of these shelters, we could see other successive groupings of 8 stools and tables of the same configuration. Walking through these beautiful facilities, I witnessed the diversity, and compared to what we had back on Earth, we had no reason to be proud. Then we entered the field of pedagogy, in other words, where the schools are located. Against my expectations, it seemed to me to be a succession of continuity, or a reproduction of what I had seen in the fields of worship, but it was still interesting. Almost the same accommodation, a multitude of little tables, each with 8 stools and, on a higher level, the teachers sit in equal numbers. "But are these classrooms?" I asked, so disappointed in my guide. "Exactly. Teaching here is carried out using a method that could be called in series, because the subject to be covered is divided into 8 defined parts, each of which must be focused on by a teacher." Discussing teaching in a series, he moved on to the details. Take, for example, a simple drinking glass. The first teacher would have to explain its shape, its convenient dimensions, as well as analyzing the details of its various shapes, comparing them with other similar containers. The second teacher would have to talk about its colors, their shades, possible variations and transformations, as well as highlighting the influences exerted by them. The third teacher would have to discuss its origin and history, referring to the date of its invention, the name of the inventor and related data. The fourth, expound on the composition of the material, the advantages of using this or that material according to the purposes for which the vessel was intended. The fifth teacher, to discuss its usefulness, its use through the ages, expanding on certain basic principles. The sixth, to explain the biography of its inventor, and integrate it with the teachings of other masters. The penultimate, to define and analyze matter in its molecular composition and, finally, try to make the chemical dosage of its elements understandable. In this way, if they wanted to know something about the chemical composition of the glass, they would turn to the third teacher. If they were in doubt about the influence of the colors, they would turn to the second teacher, and so on and so forth. A similar system is followed in the administration other disciplines, because they don't use notebooks, pencils, books and other belongings so common in your schools. The teachings are processed and propagated directly, from brain to brain, because the pupils are endowed with a prodigious memory, combined with a high level of comprehension. Their memorization is so strong that, without exception, they have the ability to remember most of the details of their childhood. I was assimilating his lecture, but stopped when an earlier puzzle came to mind. So, at that moment, my mind was oblivious to the visit I was making and, as soon as the opportunity arose, I asked him, "Why isn't the material used in certain flying craft and in certain constructions not completely transparent, as is the case in elsewhere?" "For us, the material used is always transparent, even if it isn't to you. Material that you think is semi-transparent or cloudy, so that you can't see inside, as in other cases, is crystal clear to our eyes like glass. Its interior is as diaphanous to our eyes as the ordinary glass of your windows. This is due to the penetrating power of our sight, which is 8 times stronger and, under certain conditions, its range is even greater. Therefore, what is obscured or blurred in your vision is permeable to our sight, which easily penetrates it. So, from what I can see, we're inferior?" "Absolutely, the Earthlings are not as inferior as you might think, but are going through a state of life that is entirely adjusted to the evolutionary stage they have reached. In general, it reflects the refinement of the sensitivities of certain physical organs. For your own understanding, draw a parallel between children born 50 years ago and newborns of today. You'll notice a significant difference characterized in an unmistakable way, which cannot be disputed. They are born with hair, with open eyes and, at an early age, they speak and move. So everything is perfectly right, within the evolutionary plan of Earth humanity. But what needs to be done to improve life on our planet? Improve life? Dr. Jangzhou repeated, with a certain astonishment. No, my friend. Life is the most beautiful and delightful expression of all nature that God has implanted in the universe. The essential thing is not to improve life, but to reform man. We need to reform the human being. Your humanity enjoys life on a planet that is considered a paradise compared to others, but people distort its delights and transform it into a veritable hell. Expressing himself in this way, he continued. It becomes imperative to consider that the Supreme Creator, in bestowing his blessings on planet Earth, gave it splendors and wonders, which man on Earth does not take advantage of or even appreciate. We feel saddened to see, after all, the earthly inhabitant, already at a certain level of evolution and understanding, is not able to consider these divine offerings properly and get out of the confusing tangle created by themselves. There is no doubt that there are many, many Earth people of goodwill and enlightened guidance, but unfortunately they are a minority. We need to start walking the narrow path of goodness in order to reach the broad road of love. However, everything suggests that it will only be after the end of the cycle's evolution, with profound telluric alterations, causing them severe suffering, will they be able to emerge from the chaos and instill in their hearts the supreme law of, love one another. I believe that this is the line of behavior and guidance that will set them free, and then this loving attitude will, with the advent of the third millennium, will become to be held by the majority. But did the doctor mention other planets that aren't paradises? Indeed. In the universe there are rudimentary worlds, where their inhabitants, while having the physiognomy of man, eagerly swallow raw vegetables, roots and bark as their food. Even some of your animals don't eat this way. Drinking water comes from filthy puddles and, due to the raining heat, they turn into pestilential flakes that mercilessly decimate them. Their clothing consists of a thick layer of long, coarse hair. Giant, horrifying beasts swarm and invade human settlements that have no idea how to use a simple stone spear for self-defense. They live high up on cliffs to be safe from animal attacks, in a state of true incomprehension. With incredible primitivism, they eagerly fight over the primal locations. The appearance of a mere kite in the sky would cause them terrible panic. With a firmer gaze, he added, "In your world, that doesn't happen, does it?" "Undoubtedly not. The doctor is right. Earth is a true paradise. I had already traveled through the entire field of installations, when, anxious for more details, I asked indiscreetly, wouldn't it be possible to go to that troubled planet that you mentioned, to teach them a lot of useful things and make their lives easier? I see the expression of your feelings of generosity and I recognize that it would be a highly humanitarian action. However, if we tried, we wouldn't be understood. For sure, they would try to tear us apart tooth and nail, forcing us to react in a way that is incompatible with our evolutionary level." With his proverbial attention, always ready to clarify his answers, Dr. Jangzhou went on to make the following comments. "Consider what happened on planet Earth, where Jesus, the gentle and loving Son of God, throughout his stay among men, watered them with good, fructified them with his holy love, profligated the conceptualizations of the time by inviting them to unite under the aegis of the loving Father, attesting to his words with superb miracles and marvelous miracles, he was persecuted, reviled and crucified. However, it must be taken into account that, for millennia, the Earth had been going through an evolutionary process and, at that time, there were already doctors authorized to interpret the divine science. I ask you now, can we obtain or expect success from a people who haven't even felt the glimmerings of writing, who are stuck in beginnings of understanding and yoked to the fierce struggle for survival? If we sought this adventure, we would be slaughtered, without the right to appeal to the power of defense, because our discernment foresaw with certainty the possibility of this happening. Relate this to the treatment Jesus received. Therefore, We lack the authority to act according to the dictates of our generous heart. So it is up to them to follow natural evolution through their own resources, whether physical, moral or spiritual, because it is written, to each according to his works. After a few more steps, we approached one of the video phone devices. Dr. Janzel pressed a button and it wasn't long before a monitor, answering the call, landed silently on a nearby platform. Chapter 11, The Stadium. After their long, fruitful and instructive lecture, we headed for the park craft, when Dr. Janzel asked me the following question: would you prefer to visit the agricultural area or watch a sporting competition that is currently underway in your honor? In my honor. Who am I to receive such a show of consideration? I exclaimed in surprise and then added, we should go to the competition and leave the visit to the agricultural area for later. As I made this decision, I remembered our prominent men, especially heads of state, who, when honored, failed to attend the scheduled meetings, disappointing the promoters of the reception. This attitude they have causes disappointment to the participants, who often sacrifice their interests in order to support these festivities with their presence, contributing to their greater brilliance. This behavior is commonplace among us. This constitutes a breach of commitment, with visible damage to public and private assets. Looking at myself in this mirror, I immediately decided to go and watch the sports competition. That done, we went up to the craft, and in it, immediately moved to the other side of the area we were in. A few minutes later, I spotted a building that stood out for its grandiose size and, seen from above, it was gigantic and bulky, with a circular outline. It held an enormous crowd of people crowded inside to watch the competition, which had already begun. It reminded me of the Maracanã, a sports arena in Rio de Janeiro. Famous football matches and other sporting competitions are held there. We went partway round the stadium and slowly descended to a vast courtyard where a great many craft were already parked. I could see hundreds of different types of craft. After a smooth landing, we headed towards the entrance doors. We entered under the immense stadium, majestically erected at a considerable height, free of columns, beams or struts. Something inexplicably supported the wide stands. Its walls emanated from a solid rounded base, surrounding the entire stadium, beginning at the ground next to the demarcations of the pitch. They were transparent, so that from the outside, the empty seats in the stands could be seen in the stands. Their elevation reached about 60 meters to the maximum height. I didn't see any ticket booths or ticket gates. Admission was free. The stadium looked like an immense Chinese hat with its brim turned upwards, with a magnificent sports field in the center. Its colossal base was about 6 meters high and its slightly ascending floor allowed access through numerous huge doors, having a shape reminiscent of oven mouth or furnace style doors. These doors were of considerable thickness and the walls of the stadium were like huge sheets of glass, about 80 centimeters thick. Having traveled through that monumental entrance hall, my companion and I entered the stadium itself. We soon stopped at the wide demarcation strip that encircled the pitch, taking in the view of the superb facilities, in rapt appreciation of the splendor of its layout. I didn't see any steps to reach the stands and the floor was pronouncedly concave all the way to the highest point. A series of corridors ran throughout the structure, both vertically and horizontally, allowing the spectators to reach the desired places. The whole of the seats of the geometrically arranged building was carved into the transparent material of the floor, distinctively carved with care. They were anatomical molds of the human body that highlighted the hips, the shape of the thighs, the calves and even the heels, offering excellent comfort. These anatomical shapes were molded just right to the protrusions of the body. They were intelligently arranged across the vast span of the stadium. Interspersed with the aforementioned aisles, their configuration was such that allowed their occupants to stretch out their legs, sometimes covering the corresponding anatomical cavities, or allowing them to be curled up in a lateral position. For several minutes, I watched the people, comfortably installed in the anatomical armchairs, pleasantly watching the tournament unfold in rapid moves. Their silent laughter showed their real interest in the most sensational moves of the match. You could see the ease with which these people walked along the smooth corridors. It gave me the exact impression that their feet adhered to the material of the sloping floor, fitting perfectly. When I was invited to go upstairs, despite my shoes, I slipped several times, prompting my inseparable guide to support me with his sturdy hands. So, after a careful ascent, I settled down in one of those comfortable armchairs and began to see the countryside and my surroundings. The size of the pitch must have corresponded to one of our largest official football pitches, possibly measuring around 100 by 50 meters, with circular dividing lines at the bottom. On the outside of the pitch, there was an arch with a wide opening that protruded exactly at the center dividing line and came from columns about 5 meters high, set against the sidelines. In the middle of this arch, which is the center of the pitch, there were tiny Japanese-style lanterns, three devices the size of a large lamp, of remarkable whiteness, which spread lights in a spiral shape. Likewise, the backlines and behind the semicircle marked out, there was a post about 4 meters high supporting another device very similar to those in the center of the pitch, but fitted with a spiral tube, as if it were artistically coiled. Scattered throughout the field, we could see in lines that were equidistantly arranged at a distance of about 90 centimeters, many circles with diameter a little larger than our record player discs. These circles occupied the entire length of the field, but they were much larger at the ends and under the posts mentioned earlier. The whole thing seemed to me to be a superlative architectural work of superior intelligences, elaborated under a set of irreproachable lines, in an arrangement that harmonized with its dimensions. Not a single piece or a single detail deviated from the orderly construction of the whole that made up that magnificent and grandiose stadium. Dr. Janzel began a detailed explanation of the sporting competition and, among other things, he told me what follows. The game is played between two teams made up of 23 members each, divided into 12 attackers, or forwards, and 11 defenders. Each player wears an armband about 4 fingers wide on his right leg, a kind of anklet that served to distinguish them. Thus, those belonging to one team wear blue, while their opponents wear yellow. The game consists of the players moving quickly and it is up to the defenders to prevent the attackers, who are jumping from circle to circle, from reaching their goal. It is obvious that it is only legal to use the circles, and it is considered a foul to step on one already occupied. The start of the game takes place with the distribution on one wing, that is, half of the pitch, of 12 forwards from board A, against 11 defenders from board B. In the other half of the pitch, 12 forwards from team B are positioned against 11 defenders from team A. The initial arrangement is delimited by a sector of the pitch, within which the players of the team that is going to start the match place themselves, taking into account, of course, prior arrangements. It is therefore up to the opposing team to arrange their defenders in such a way as to offer the greatest chance of defense. Even if this layout is one-on-one, one circle will always remain vacant for both team A and team B, since the defenders are fewer in number. The defensive technique of either team depends on that of the attack it is experiencing. In order to win a goal, the player must jump from circle to circle, dodging opponents until he reaches the goal located in the final semicircle. As for the opponent's defending technique, it consists of occupying the possible vacant circles that prevent the opposing player from accessing their goal. For the attacking player to progress and overcome the opponent's defense, he must step exactly inside the circles. It is not allowed to reach them by touching the edge, as this will cause a foul to be signaled. The method of recognizing fouls is perfect, there can be no cheating. The human judges are replaced by highly sensitive devices that detect the offender without any danger of deception. Once the offense has been committed, there is a sudden flash of light, identical to the color of the fouled player's anklet and the spectator, even if distracted, was aware of the foul by the board whose color flashed. At the same time, an indicative ray of light projected from the circle where the offense was committed to the offender's anklet, highlighting him to the public and, in the center of the field, one of the white lights becomes illuminated, in the middle of the pitch. In this way, the switching on of the lights, yellow or blue, was a general warning given by the flashing of the light, and confirmed in the center of the field by one of the corresponding lights. At the same time, the offender is indicated to the public by the beams projected directly from the circle to his anklet. In my humble opinion, that Sports Center Square was equipped with state-of-the-art electronic devices, in an advantageous and infallible replacement of the referee, with perfect marking of fouls and speed in authorizing new plays. We wish we had such precision in refereeing our football matches. We'd certainly avoid brawls, arguments, and even the usual police intervention against certain fans. Once the offense had been detected by the sensors and announced via the floodlights, everyone remained stationary in the position in which they found themselves until a new light was projected, signifying that everything was normalized. Then, when the third spotlight went out, the play was automatically authorized to continue. When the player on a board was in position, that is standing with his foot in one of the circles, and his opponent stepped into that same circle, the light indicating the foul would come on. The astonishing accuracy with which the beam of light pinpointed the offender without any danger of error really baffled me. A try or point was scored when a player hit the larger circle in the center of the semicircle, at the edge of the pitch. Then, at that moment, profuse illumination was spread by the device at the top of the post behind the goal. This light invaded the whole area and was colored according to the anklet of the player who had hit the opposing goal. At this point, the game was brought to a standstill and the players returned to their places, jumping round in a circle ready to take up their attack and defense positions and waiting for the third midfield light beam to go out. Once this was done, they began their incursions, making moves in a rapid succession of clever dodges that resulted in unexpected surprises, sometimes allowing the less targeted players to make progress and achieve success. The pitch is entirely smooth, with dark brown circles standing out. The posts and arch were made of identical material, but were as transparent as very pure glass and in no way hindered the spectator's perfect vision. It's important that the number of fouls committed during the game is low. It's not always the team with the most points that wins the match. Dr. Jansel told me in his report, it's no use Team A scoring 30 points and having 80 fouls, when Team B only scored 20 points and only had 30 fouls. When calculating the percentage, logically B is the winner, because the lowest number of fouls is considered a high technical score. If one of the players uses physical brutality against his opponent, the contest is over, the contest stops and his team is considered the loser. The player who committed the violence is taken to a hospital to undergo rigorous treatment of his mental faculties. Isn't that something else? Are these absences common? No, in fact they are the exception. The last time a player threw a teammate to the ground was, precisely 42 years ago, and we haven't seen a similar case since. How well does this sport develop its participants' physique? I inquired about the benefits of practicing it. Incredibly, the practice of this sport benefits their physique as if they were swimming, playing football and chess at the same time. Playing chess? How can that be? The strategy of tactical positions on the field is a real chess problem, because the aim is to obtain this or that position, which makes it impossible to prevent a goal being scored. Here, as in the game of chess, it is possible to obtain unbeatable positions that result in victory. Tactics combined with speed and agility were the characteristics of the game, and I doubt that our best earth athletes compete with any success against these beings. The physical fitness of the players was visible, as was their training together. They looked like automatons, moving with incredible ease, dodging opponents and always creating opportunities for their teammates. From the stands you could see the tactical movement and, unexpectedly realized positions of visible threat to one of the players. As I began to understand the moves, I started to root for the blue board, as it was the brightest color and my favorite. In the most sensational moves, the fans anticipating, of course, the immediate consequences, would wave their arms or follow the play with gestures and silent laughter.